Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Turner Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show. In the movie Jaws, people were terrorized by a shark. Today, the tables have turned and sharks are suffering overfishing. New regulations have been proposed, but fishermen say they won't help. We get down and dirty and talk green about composting. It's not as messy as you'd think. People are doing it in kitchen drawers in Manhattan and backyards in Oregon. And the Earth Calendar celebrates the American harvest of citrus in Florida. We're picking oranges and grapefruit, and the juice runneth over. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Sharks. The mere mention of the word conjures images of heartless killers lurking in the oceans, just waiting for us to step into the water. But sharks are integral members of aquatic ecosystems. Worldwide overfishing is depleting the numbers of sharks, and scientists say it will take decades for their populations to recover. The United States has proposed new regulations, but more work will be necessary. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
You gingerly wade into the shimmering warm water. It's eerily calm, and then you see a single fin slicing through the water. Your heart races as you realize it's too late to escape the 12-foot giant shark. More than a few nights of sleep were interrupted after the movie Jaws came out. The movie supported fears that sharks are evil creatures, but times have changed.
The Shark College has become a very popular natural food supplement because of its claimed healing power for cancer, primarily. Shark fins have been traditionally used in East China, Hong Kong, Taiwan. Shark fin soup is very famous, very delicious too. Also, shark liver oil has been used as a high concentrated vitamin A source.
Django Wang is a PhD and manager of the Center for Natural Wellness in Albany, New York. Today's shark products are more popular than ever, and that's created a problem. In 1979, there were 300,000 pounds of shark taken from U.S. waters. By 1989, it jumped to 16 million pounds. Bill Hogarth is the chief of the Highly Migratory Species Division of the National Marine Fisheries Service, a wing of the federal government.
Well, basically, depending on the species, we deal with 39 different species, but most of them are reduced from the 80s to by about 50 to 75%. And so there's been rather severe decline in the populations of most of the large coastal in particular, and then some to the small coastal and pelagic sharks.
The severe depletion has prompted a new round of strict regulations, which will cut a good part of the shark catch by 50%. This is on top of regulations enacted just a few years ago. Hogarth says the 50% cut still won't improve matters much.
We cannot continue fishing at the level that we were fishing, that the mortality need to be reduced at least 50% just to maintain the populations at the reduced level, 25 to 50% of what they were, and maybe start some rebuilding. But if you wanted to really rebuild them, you probably need a complete closure. We felt like that, that would be a very drastic step for closure at the present time. So we chose the 50% reduction as a proposed rule.
The folks who will lose the most under the new regulations are fishermen. In the 1980s, the government, seeing a lucrative and growing market for shark products, encouraged fishermen to switch to sharks. Prices for shark fins can fetch up to $200 a pound. A bowl of shark fin soup can cost $90. And with a growing and more affluent Asian population, the demand for shark will only go up. Nelson Biderman is the executive director of the Blue Water Fishermen's Association. He says the government is bowing to pressure from environmentalists.
About 50%. Is just chosen as what the environmental community is pushing. We don't know if any reduction is necessary, let alone any figure from zero to 100. But why pick 50%? The 50% is going to have a dramatic impact on the directed fisheries that National Marine Fisheries Service worked hard to encourage development of. It's going to essentially take them out. They work on a very slim profit margin.
But environmentalists counter, saying the problem is clear and growing. Andrea Gaske is the director of research for Traffic USA, a wildlife trade monitoring program of the World Wildlife Fund. She agrees that the research is insufficient and numbers are often unreliable, but says that sharks are not like other fish and must be treated differently.
Well, we're not really sure how bad the overfishing of sharks is. We know that sharks are taken in almost every fishery of the world. If they're fishing for bluefin tuna, then they take sharks because sharks hang out where other fish are. But the sharks are particularly vulnerable to overexploitation because they often only produce a few young a year. A bluefin tuna can produce millions of larvae a year. A shark might produce a couple young every other year, every 3 years. It depends on the gestation process. So in some ways, sharks are like mammals rather than fish, and therefore they're much more vulnerable to overexploitation than other fish.
Fishermen argue that the new regulations won't help sharks. They say many species of sharks migrate in and out of U.S. waters, so any regulations will have to be implemented in conjunction with other nations.
We're concerned with U.S. fishermen being disadvantaged and being asked to carry the entire conservation burden for species after species. The U.S. is only one small player. To take the steps of trying to rebuild these stocks unilaterally is simply unfair to U.S. fishermen.
The National Marine Fisheries Service says they are working with other nations, specifically Mexico, on developing regulations for shark fishing. Andrea Gaske says the regulations are a good start, but much more needs to be done.
The Shark Management Plan of the United States is a good management plan, but it's about 5 years too late right now, so we're looking at severely depleted populations of sharks in the Atlantic Ocean.
It was only 15 years ago when sharks had no market and were viewed as trash fish. When Jaws came out, it became fashionable to catch great whites, but today great whites are among the most threatened shark species. Although fear of sharks may cause some to lose sleep, it's the sharks that have a lot more to fear than we do. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
This is Talking Green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Today, we're talking about composting. That's the process by which organic matter rots and can then be returned to the soil. Composting takes many forms. You can pile up your yard waste and your food scraps and make soil for the home garden or lawn. If you live in a city that has a composting program, they'll separate organic waste and let it cook in piles, which are mixed with wood chips and turned over with front-end loaders. In some places, sewage sludge from sewage treatment plants is composted and then sold to gardeners, farmers, or it's used in public landscapes. We have two guests with us today, Manna Jo Green, who is with the Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency in upstate New York and can talk about composting for the homeowner, and Jean Bonital from Cornell Waste Management Institute at Cornell University. Her specialty is industrial composting and sewage sludge. Manna Jo Green, let's start with you. Composting for the household, a useful way of getting rid of America's ever-growing amount of household waste, or just some quirky fad for a handful of home gardeners?
No, I think it's a very useful way to deal with organic waste from households, which includes yard and garden waste, food scraps, and I particularly encourage people to, when they're building a compost heap, whether it's an enclosed heap or an open pile, to layer the two. That's the various organisms that turn organic matter into the soil amendment that we call compost. Like both carbon and nitrogen, and food scraps are primarily nitrogen.
So how long does it have to cook if you're doing it yourself in your backyard?
Well, it depends on the size of your pile. If you can get a pile that's at least 3 foot cubed, you can get a good hot cooking pile, especially if you have a lot of nitrogen material, combined with leaves and yard waste, which are carbon sources. It can cook in as soon as 3 to 6 months or take as long as a year to 18 months. And if you're composting just plain leaves, it can even take 2 years. Leaves and very woody materials like branches and brush.
Jean, let's look at this from an industrial side for a moment, and let's talk about sewage sludge. I would assume that sewage sludge is going to be with us as long as sewage treatment plants are processing sewage waste. And the real question is, if this is a good idea, why aren't more cities doing it?
Some places are composting their sewage sludge. They still have to have a place to ultimately dispose of it. And some of the sewage sludge is higher in heavy metals than other sewage sludge, so some of it has limited uses.
And are a lot of cities composting their sludge now?
More and more. It's more becoming an alternative.
And what are they doing with the compost that they're producing?
Some places have clean enough sludge that they're land spreading it in parks or golf courses or green spaces, some forestry operations. Some places don't. Some places have to landfill it and things like that. They still have to contain it.
Okay, so we're talking about composting either at the municipal level or in your backyard. Let's go to the phones and hear from John Fosside from Portland, Oregon. John, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Yes. Out here in Portland, we also compost sewage sludge, but we put it in bags and we sell it to the general public on a very small scale. And the overall feeling is that it's good for our gardens out here.
And, John, I gather one of the concerns about using municipal sludge in gardens is that it's contaminated with heavy metals, or could be, and that might produce a problem for somebody who's growing vegetables. Jean or Manajo, what are the kind of problems that are presented, and has Portland got an answer that works here?
Depending on how much industry you have in your waste stream, you may have heavy metals or you may not. A lot of times what communities are doing is they're going backwards up the waste stream and looking at who might be producing some of the heavy metals, and they're catching the heavy metals before they even get into the sewage sludge.
John, how do you cope with that in Portland?
Well, our heavy metal content has to comply with EPA federal regulations, so there's two types of use for the end product, and all sewage sludge has to comply with EPA federal regs.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in compliance with that, and we can distribute ours to the general public.
Most municipalities are having a heck of a time getting rid of their sludge. What do we do with it? Is this something that has real potential and ought to be expanded around the country?
There's no reason why it shouldn't be expanded. It's a good way to manage sewage sludge.
And so, John, as far as you're concerned, is all of Portland's sludge being processed this way now?
No. Just a very small portion of it is. It's a pilot project, and it's not taking the total waste stream out. I can see where this program could be expanded. A good market for it would be the agricultural market for land application.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. And now let's go clear across the United States and talk to Emily from Ulster County. Emily, you're talking green.
Hello, thank you. I wanted to know about my home compost pile, and I wanted to know, I know that I need a lot of nitrogen and carbon, and I think of that as green and brown. And where can I get some brown material in the summer? I seem to have lots of green material.
Now, Emily, before we get an answer from our panel, how long have you had your compost pile?
Probably 3 to 5 years, but I don't work it really hard. In other words, I'm I let it kind of set, and I don't try to get it to go really fast, so I'd like to kind of speed up the process.
You
want to
speed it up and really make it cook. Okay.
Yes.
What do our guests, what advice do they have for Emily, who needs to cook that compost more effectively?
Well, Peter, I'll take a crack at this. This is Manna Green. I encourage, if you really want to speed up a pile, although Emily indicated that she had a lot of nitrogen sources and she needed carbon sources. Carbon is widely available in leaves, so when she rakes the leaves, if she'll make a pile of leaves near her compost pile and then layer the food and the other fresh grass is also high in nitrogen. And those are the things that tend to speed up the pile. The carbon sources tend to slow it down, but the organisms really like a balance of both. I just wanted to also add the tremendous potential for composting from large food waste generators such as hospitals, schools, restaurants, food processing businesses. There's a tremendous potential to get very clean compost by composting food from those sources, and also shredded paper is another organic material in addition to food, yard waste, and sludge. So
that seems like such an important idea when you think of the size of institutions, whether they be hospitals or universities and so on. Is anybody doing that on a large scale now?
Yes, there are both. We're working with businesses and institutions to compost some of their food stream. It's catching on slowly, but it's something that's moving along. We do have.
And when you do that, do you ask the institution to build their own pits, or do they get help from local governments who would have to get rid of their garbage anyway?
Yeah, either they can build windrows, long rows that they can compost the material in, or some of the places we are doing some composting in New York City where they're using containers that they're composting in. So it depends. They also can find someone who does composting for a business, and they can separate their food scraps and send them to somebody that has a business that composts them.
Now, when you're talking about long rows here, we're talking about piling this stuff on concrete slabs and mixing it with front-end loaders on tractors. Is that the way that's done?
Oftentimes, there are compost turners and there are mixers, different kinds of mixers. Generally, it's put on some kind of a asphalt or concrete pad or just a hard packed surface, depending on the regulations in the state.
And how useful is this in terms of reducing the amount of garbage that's got to be dealt with, which is again a huge problem all over the United States? Is composting a solution here?
Definitely. Up to 75% of a cafeteria's or a hospital's waste can be organic matter that can be composted. And it's something that they can, again, use. They can compost the material and then use it on their landscaping, especially campuses. You know, anybody who has some kind of a campus that they're trying to that have to buy the stuff for anyway.
And, Peter, I'd like to add that in Ulster County, our goal is to divert 72.5% of the waste stream using a combination of waste reduction, recycling, and composting. And we do figure that a third of the weight of the general municipal waste stream is compostable.
And so how are you going to separate that, or do you expect the homeowner and the institution to do that? How does that work?
It's not that hard to separate. We just suggest that people set up two containers, one for their organic waste, well, three containers, one for their organic waste, one for their recyclables, and one for their actual trash, stuff that can't be composted or recycled. And they're, for instance, in the Culinary Institute of America, they're teaching the students right up front to do that. And then they'll be able to bring it out to a lot more institutions where they're working and on, and it should be able to grow that way.
Now, I want to ask you both about a friend of mine. I have a friend who has an apartment in New York City, and in the third drawer of his kitchen, he grows worms, which are part of his local composting process. Whether his landlord knows that he does this or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
How about it? Worms in the kitchen drawer, is this a useful way to deal with solid waste on a major scale?
There are people that do worm composting indoors in their basement, in this case in the kitchen drawer, in a recycling box. I've seen it, and it's a very effective, useful technique. Basically, you just feed your food to the worms, and they turn it into soil. But it does take a little tending and a little care, and you have to want to have pet worms in order to do vermiculture or worm composting.
Yeah. New York Hospital is actually using vermiculture right now to deal with some of their food scraps.
So this isn't wacky at all. It's actually
no, it's not.
Being
They're
done.
Actually using it down in the at the hospital.
I feel better about my friend already.
It's also a good thing for people who don't want to tromp through the snow to get to a compost heap, that they use regular outdoor composting in the nice weather, and then in the middle of the winter they may have a worm bin down in their basement to get through the winter, and then bring that material out and mix it together and start all over again the following winter.
Okay. Well,
you do have to use a specific type of worm for this. It's a red worm, not your regular earthworms. It's a worm that likes warmer climates.
Okay. Well, that's good advice, and I want to thank you both. I'm afraid our time is up, but we've been joined by Manna Jo Green from New York's Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency and Jean Bonital from Cornell University. If you want to talk green on the Environment Show, give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. Now it's time for the Earth Calendar, and we continue our series on the Great American Harvest. Each month, we visit folk who are harvesting a crop to see how it's going, recognizing that what we eat depends on our environment and the stewardship of those who, with the help of nature, produce it. Right now, we're in the middle of the harvest season for oranges and grapefruit in Florida. Bobby McCowan, Executive Vice President and CEO of the Florida Citrus Mutual in Lakeland, Florida, says it's a record crop, particularly for grapefruit, which is at an all-time high.
Well, the citrus crop this year in Florida is a record crop. We have 220 million boxes of oranges that the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, has estimated we'll produce. That will be an all-time record. We have 59 million boxes of grapefruit that is estimated. That, too, is an all-time record. And then we have about 10 million boxes of specialty fruit, which would be your tangerines, your zipper skin fruit, for fresh shipment. And again, you take all that together, that would be a record crop in Florida.
And what is it that made for a record crop this year?
Well, during the series of the during the 80s, we had a series of 100-year statistical freezes that killed significant acreage of trees in Florida. Approximately one half of the industry was destroyed. Following those freezes, the industry replanted with the new rootstocks and technology, and so our tree, we're coming back into production as a result of that following the freezes of the 80s.
James Blood of Blood's Hammock Groves in Delray Beach, Florida, grows fruit on land that was originally planted as citrus by his grandfather in 1920. He says the harvesting process hasn't changed much.
The harvest is pretty much like it has always been, probably for the last 70 years. Majority of it is picked with ladders and by hand, and that's really not changed. There's been some research on mechanical harvesting, but that's not been completely successful. And in the fresh fruit industry, certainly hand harvesting will be the main way to get them off the tree for some time, I'm sure.
Picking the orange and grapefruit is the culmination of a process which starts years before when the tree is planted, a time that Jim Blood likes the best.
Well, citrus is really a beautiful tree. Different varieties have a little bit different appearance. They're evergreen. They bloom in the spring, in March, February, March. And just to see these orange balls form and this time of year when it's so cold up north, and to think that we're harvesting these beautiful trees and getting this wonderful tasting fruit off of it is just great. Of course, me personally, one of the things that I really enjoy is planting the young trees and watching them grow and making them productive.
There may come a time when biologically engineered citrus trees will resist cold, and the fluctuations of production caused by frosts a decade earlier won't exist anymore. But for now, we celebrate the bounty of the Florida citrus groves, where the harvest is at a juicy all-time high. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the Great Lakes are the focus of efforts to control persistent organic pollutants like PCBs. We'll have a report from Chicago. Paul Ehrlich and other advisory council members look backwards and forwards at the North American environment. Author Jerry Dennis takes us from a Michigan creek to the Great Lakes, to the atmosphere and back to the creek, all in the cold of winter. And finally, a song about saving water and your dog, who probably doesn't care. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Research has told us that man-made chemicals like PCBs remain in the environment for a very long time. They don't break down or chemically self-destruct. They also travel for thousands of miles as they move from smokestack or sewer to the air and water and through animals. In the Coburn book, Our Stolen Future, a PCB molecule is tracked from a source on the east coast of the United States, across the country, and ultimately into the body fat of a polar bear in the Arctic. A number of efforts are underway to control and ultimately eliminate persistent organic pollutants, otherwise known as POPs, from the environment. In North America, discussion of POPs leads to the Great Lakes, which receive substantial quantities from water which flows into them and from the atmosphere. Steve Frankel from the Great Lakes Radio Consortium reports.
The conference began with a sobering statement by John Buccini, a leading expert on persistent organic pollutants.
If you were to do body fat analysis of any person in this room, I'm 99.9%+ certain that you will have PCBs in your body, as well as DDT and metabolites, and quite a number of other organochlorine materials.
PCBs, dioxins, and pesticides like DDT have been found in people, animals, and plants. These persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, accumulate in the food chain. They are thought to cause behavioral, hormonal, immune, and reproductive disorders in both humans and wildlife. These pollutants are transported by wind, water, and rain, and can travel thousands of miles from their source, ending up in cooler climates like the Great Lakes. Milton Clark is a scientist with the Environmental Protection Agency. He says a global solution is needed because these chemicals disregard national borders as they travel.
As we learn more about these chemicals, we realize that we're really on an international stage, and that, for instance, DDT usage in Mexico to control malaria may ultimately end up in the Great Lakes. And we can also find out that even the PCBs that are in our Great Lakes may end up in the Arctic.
Research in the Great Lakes found these toxins to be dangerous. That prompted the United States and Canada to work together to protect the Great Lakes ecosystem and the people who live in it. Through a binational organization called the International Joint Commission, the two countries enacted the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement and the Toxic Substance Control Agreement to phase out POPs from the Great Lakes. Jack Weinberg of Greenpeace says this kind of political cooperation sparked the current international movement to abolish persistent organic pollutants.
It's been here in the Great Lakes that a whole understanding of an elimination strategy of sunsetting sources, that is, deciding that over a period of time we are going to eliminate the source, we're going to do it in an economically coherent way. These policies that are also moving around the world also have their origin here.
Weinberg adds that one reason the effort to solve the POPs problem in the Great Lakes has been successful is because environmentalists and the chemical industry have had a voice in the debate. Though they're at the negotiating table, representatives of the chemical industry say that as long as people want products that contain dangerous toxins, it will be difficult to stop producing them. George Cooper of the Council of Great Lakes Industries says these toxic chemicals serve a practical purpose.
There's disagreement. And the disagreement is based on the understanding that there is first, in some cases, no substitute for some POPs applications. We need those for some of the products that we feel, as a society, we need. The question is, how can we manage those pollutants so that they do not become a problem in the environment?
Chemical companies aren't alone in their concern over the economic costs of stricter regulations. The millions of people worldwide who work to produce toxic chemicals see phasing out POPs as a threat to their jobs. Les Leopold represents the American Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union.
It is not a win-win situation. We are in favor of elimination of toxic substances. However, we can only do so if the job implications are considered and carefully dealt with. At the moment, those issues aren't being addressed at all. As a result, the people who are going to pay the highest price for cleaning up the world's environment are going to be the workers whose livelihoods are directly dependent on it.
Finding substitutes for these toxic chemicals and ensuring that displaced workers are justly compensated are two major barriers to solving the global POPs problem. Jack Weinberg of Greenpeace says he hopes citizens groups like his can use their Great Lakes experience to help governments and industry overcome these hurdles at the international level.
There's quite a bit of momentum here representing public interest in eliminating the sources of these pollutants. Our challenge is to focus that on successful outcome of the global negotiations relative to our own governments, but also to seek contacts and allies in other countries around the world that can play the same role relative to their governments.
But fellow environmentalist Barbara Rutherford of the World Wildlife Fund says she's skeptical about the possibility of negotiating an effective international POPs agreement. She says while much has been accomplished in removing POPs from the Great Lakes, problems remain.
We're still not there in terms of the Great Lakes. These contaminants are still there. They're still being spewed out in thousands of pounds per day. So that makes me wonder about whether or not we're going to achieve anything realistic at the international level, because we now have a very complicated political environment of developing countries wanting development and wanting to use the same chemicals that we use to get our development.
This month, environmentalists, policymakers, and other representatives of the Great Lakes region will attend a United Nations meeting in Nairobi, Kenya. There, they will try to build on the accomplishments of the Great Lakes region as dozens of countries work toward an international agreement to eliminate persistent organic pollutants. For the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, I'm Steve Frankel in Chicago.
As the new year begins, the Environment Show asked its Council of Advisors how they evaluated the previous 12 months and what they hope to see in the coming year. We speak now with three of our advisors who have varying backgrounds. The first is John Wirth. He sees the development of environmental policy in a historical perspective, not surprisingly because he is professor of history at Stanford University in California, president of the North American Institute in Santa Fe, and a member of the Joint Public Advisory Committee of the Council of Environmental Cooperation, established under the North American Free Trade Agreement. The second is Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies and Professor of Biological Sciences, also at Stanford University. Dr. Ehrlich has earned international renown for his writings on population and his scientific research in the fields of biology and ecology. The third is Jonathan Plout, recently retired director of environmental quality for the multinational Allied Signal Corporation. He is outgoing chairman of the Joint Public Advisory Committee to the Council on Environmental Cooperation and is a committed environmentalist who spent his corporate career improving the environmental performance of industry. John Wirth, let me start with you. Last year, you expressed hope that an airshed agreement between Juarez, Mexico, and El Paso, Texas could be reached, and you were also looking forward to what you hoped was institutional steps toward the protection of the environment between our three countries. How do you think things went in 96, and what are you looking forward to in 97?
Peter, I'm very pleased on both accounts. The Juarez-El Paso agreement was signed in Mexico City this May, and for the first time ever in a transborder agreement of this kind, private citizens are given equal recognition and stature with federal and state officials to advise and then develop a plan for the airshed. This is a building block for a number of cross-border and sub-regional air plans that may lead to a North American comprehensive air agreement. And as you know, because you're on the Joint Public Advisory Committee with me, the Commission on Environmental Cooperation in Montreal is conducting now a continent-wide review of air compliance and looking into a broad range of airborne pollutants and how to monitor those and begin to get an inventory of where we are, looking toward a comprehensive continental view of air, which last year I thought was the way to go. And I'm very pleased to see that this is the momentum which could lead to the first really big achievement of the Environmental Commission under NAFTA, justifying in spades the site agreement, I might say.
Great. Paul Ehrlich, last year you were concerned about our overpopulation and felt that we were making some progress there, and you were totally discouraged about anybody's ability to deal with overconsumption.
Yeah,
how has the year gone? And also, by the way, it was a year in which you published an exciting new book.
Well, I still am very concerned about overconsumption. That problem is not going to go away fast. I have been cheered by the by two things. One is the reception of the book among my colleagues. It was basically produced. It's called The Trail of Science and Reason, and was basically produced to expose a lot of the so-called brown lash, that is, the things people have been saying about the environment that simply aren't true. And we had a launch of the book at the headquarters of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the president of the association came to help launch it and so on. So we've had enormous support from our colleagues. I would say for the future, the most cheering thing I've seen is work actually that's being done by Dr. Gretchen Daly here at Stanford in trying to bring industry into an understanding of the importance of ecosystem services to our entire society, and organizing prominent people in industry to join prominent scientists to get behind the whole movement to preserve the life support systems that we depend on. And that has had more success than I expected, and looking forward to even more success. There's going to be a big event around it at the meetings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in February in Seattle. So I'm cheered about that.
John Plout, last year you expressed some hope about cooperative training for industry representatives that was going to take place in Mexico to establish higher environmental standards and codes of conduct through ISO 14000, among other things. And you were quite optimistic about how that process was going. How do you look at 96, and what do you hope may happen in 97?
Well, Peter, as my colleagues have already expressed, I think there were some very good signs during 1996 on that front. During 1996, the three industry groups from the U.S., Canada, and from Mexico went forward with their agreement as to joint training, and in fact put together a process which I am pleased to serve on the board of, which will provide training to medium and small size companies in first in central Mexico and in Mexico generally, and then hopefully that will be a good start towards the future across our three countries. Let me say in that particular regard that that training will be carried on by industry people from all three countries and the Mexican government, and is being funded by the CEC, that is the NAFTA Environmental Commission, and Mexican industry, particularly an organization called FUNTEC, which is a Mexican industry association. So I think there's been a very good start on that in that regard, and there is a very strong intent on the part of industry of all three countries to move forward. During 1997, we will see that really start to play out in terms of workshops, training programs, development of development of new techniques for smaller and medium-sized companies in Mexico, where there is a particular need, and I can see that developing into something very worthwhile.
I hear you all talking about what really may be a dichotomy with respect to industry. We hear both Johns talking about better environmental standards of conduct, and Paul, you've written a book about the fact that at least some folk in the industrial side of things have been trashing science in ways that certainly does not favor the environmental cause. Is industry waking up, or is there indeed this large division?
I think there's a large division, and I think that obviously within big industries there are a lot of environmentalists, even in organizations that are working in the wrong direction. But there are at the top of some companies, for instance, at the top of Monsanto, people who clearly want to change the way industry performs because they understand that all human beings have to live on the same planet, whether they're university professors or housewives or CEOs of large companies. The most obvious place we discuss in detail in Betrayal of Science and Reason, where industry has been pushing in the wrong direction, are the various organizations that contribute to the push to continue to burn fossil fuels, like the Western Fuels Association, the Global Climate Coalition, which just put out long series of lies about what's going on in the atmosphere and have been personally attacking some of the best atmospheric scientists, the ones involved in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, particularly Ben Santer, which it's been really disgusting.
I think your use of the word dichotomy is a very good word, Peter. There are within industry, just as there are within all other parts of the population, different points of view, and there are parts of industry that have been working against good sound environmental progress. And we saw that in the last election, and we saw the Clinton administration stand up against that, and were really quite successful. On the other hand, there are parts of industry which are working and see the value of moving forward in the environment, and are working on programs cooperatively, not only with each other but with government and with other private groups, and so we really do have a dichotomy. My hope is that as time goes on and it becomes clearer and clearer that good environmental management is in fact good management, and I believe that very strongly, as you know, that as that becomes clearer and clearer, that the strength of the forces who seem to work against the environment with industry will start to pale. As they see the good competitive reasons for being pro-environment.
I agree with the thrust of both these comments. All I could add is that there was a shocking degree of opportunism that surfaced in the last 2 years with the changeover in the Congress and the chance to grab on a short-term basis, and perhaps this feeds into one of the weaknesses of the industry approach, which is it is responsible for short-term results and has a difficult time taking the long view. So it rewards this sort of predatory behavior or short-term opportunism where there is almost a schizophrenic view within the corporation between the two forces. And one would hope that that would level out as we get a longer-term point of view. But certainly I support the goals that John, with his corporate experience, has expressed, and the hope that Paul has expressed, that the truth will prevail.
On that subject, what are things that could be done from the public policy standpoint, or things that private individuals could be doing in 97 to encourage the green hats and discourage the black hats?
I think there's no substitute for people in our society learning as much as they can about environmental issues, which I think are the major security issues today, because one of the things I found out in working on the Brown Lash and writing the book was even I could be fooled. On the ALAR question, I had gotten sort of the message that probably environmental groups had gone too far on it. When Ann and I looked at it closely, it turned out, in fact, they hadn't. So if you don't pay any real attention, you're going to have a lot of trouble sorting out what should be done from what shouldn't be done.
I would certainly echo those thoughts, and I would also say that environmental literacy is a very important subject for people to become conversant with the issues of the environment in an intelligent way, absent slogans, if possible, so that they start to really understand the issues and become conversant in it. I would also say that there are legitimate issues in terms of the environment, in terms of streamlining the way we manage the environment on a government level and on a private level, which need to be focused on, and which would certainly help our regulatory process. So we need to try and not throw the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, although we do not want a repressive anti-environment view, we also would like to make our management of the environment more cooperative. And actually, Carol Browner and the USEPA have been working hard at that in the last few years, and that has begun to show results in terms of some of their environmental leadership efforts.
Well, I think we would all agree that green is the wave of the future. People have to listen and become well informed, and this is the great power of the information age. The quality of that information, how it gets to people, is a critical importance, and the role of NGOs here is absolutely fundamental. And as the whole movement matures and develops a greater ease with working with other stakeholders, particularly with business and industry, we should see some real efforts to reach large groups of the public and bring them in coalitions to work toward a less confrontational and more systemic look and a long-term look at the environment. This is certainly the hope. Although, as we've seen, the Internet can be used for all sorts of purposes, and it could be that it could be a source of disinformation just as much as it would be for the sort of information that we would want.
Mm-hmm. One real short question as we sum up. Each of you, as you look forward, are you optimistic or pessimistic, or is that the wrong question to ask?
Well, I'm very optimistic about what we could do in making the genuine information overwhelmingly the bad information and getting market-based systems, very often which are superior often to command and control systems, in place to take care of the environment. But I'm pessimistic about what we are going to do in the United States about consumption and in the United States about our population problems. I have to be convinced that we're actually going to start moving in the right direction one of these days, and I haven't been convinced of that.
Paul, you're more optimistic than I've heard you in a long time. That's the right word. Maybe tilting toward a degree of optimism. But from my point of view, the real problems we're going to face now are not so much the development of environmental consciousness, which seems to be moving along and hopefully can be nourished better, but the problem of the limits of how much we're going to be able to pay to do what's required to take it into the deeper steps of remediation and sustainability. I don't think the American public particularly has any idea of the sort of sacrifices and the new way of looking at things that it's going to require to really take it where we know it should go. And the politics of that is extremely murky as of yet, and we have to do a lot of creative thinking as to how we're going to get there.
I would say that as to the issue of put the opposite way around that my colleagues have, as to the issue of population, I am still very pessimistic because I don't see yet steps being taken to deal with that overwhelming and overriding issue across our globe. To other issues, though, I feel optimistic, guardedly optimistic, because I've seen now great cooperative efforts, for example, across North America on specific programs involving chemicals, involving the regulation of chemicals, involving the tracking, involving the management of the infrastructure, and finally, of course, involving public participation. Which, as John mentioned, we have seen really the start of real public participation in terms of the North American environment. So I feel optimistic in that sense, although population to me is such an overwhelming problem that it doesn't allow me to be any more than guardedly optimistic.
Paul Ehrlich is professor of biological sciences at Stanford University, and Jonathan Plout is former director of environmental quality at Allied Signal. They are all members of the Advisory Council of the Environment Show. All of us have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city block. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Author Jerry Dennis makes a portrait from his book, The Bird and the Waterfall, A Natural History of Oceans, Rivers, and Lakes.
In my childhood, I spent a lot of time exploring Lake Michigan's northeast shore. To me, calling the lake an inland sea did it an injustice. It was no mere sea, it was an ocean, almost an arm of the Atlantic, connected by canals and navigable rivers to all the oceans and seas. Its borders were invisible beyond unbroken horizons, and it was sailed by the ships of dozens of nations. The beaches along what is now Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore in northwest Michigan were long and undeveloped, and it was unusual to see anyone there. I would walk the shore looking for treasures. In lines of debris marking the reach of the last storm, I found drowned butterflies and ladybug beetles, plastic toys washed pale of color, lost fishing lures. The aluminum floats from the nets of commercial fishermen seemed so exotic they could have been lost by Polynesians. There was driftwood shaped like herons and gazelles. There were silver polished tree trunks as large as Roman columns that had washed up in storms and become half buried in sand. In the brightly colored gravel at the water's edge were stones worn round as marbles, and bits of polished glass the color and texture of candy half dissolved on your tongue. Gulls and terns soared above the waves, and pencil-legged sandpipers ran on the wet sand. Every day the beach was different. A strong west wind would bring waves that swept miles of shore clean or washed up the wrecked ribs of an old lifeboat. Each spring, after a winter of grinding ice and pounding surf, the beach would be transformed. Trees that had stood on precarious banks would be gone, their banks stolen from beneath them. Where the beach had been wide, it was narrow. Where it had been narrow, it was wide. Rocks the size of bushel baskets were gone, and new ones cluttered places that had been rock-free the year before. There was novelty everywhere, every day. On summer nights, my parents sometimes built bonfires of driftwood on the beach, and we sat up late cooking marshmallows, watching meteors, and listening to the waves. In the darkness, Lake Michigan seemed smaller, more lake than sea. Some nights it was so calm there were no waves at all, only a breath-like, whispering cadence you sensed before you heard, and the stars were reflected in a mirror universe as far as you could see. Other nights the wind would be up, and we would gather on the upwind side of the fire and watch sparks stream down the beach. I noticed that when I put my ear to the ground on the high knolls above the beach, I could hear each wave's thumping impact before the sound came through the air. I didn't know then that sound travels much faster through the ground than through the air. I thought I was hearing echoes or the thump of mysterious subterranean waves, and it did not occur to me to ask my parents for an explanation. It was just another mystery. Until you reach a certain age, everything is equally amazing. Waves can romp through the earth and sparks fly off to join stars, and if you are quiet and listen very carefully, you can hear voices in the water.
Jerry Dennis is author of The Bird and the Waterfall, A Natural History of Oceans, Rivers, and Lakes. We've heard about water from various perspectives, so we close with reflections about water conservation from my friend Bill Oliver, a songwriter and environmental troubadour from Austin, Texas. His song, Please Don't Leave the Water Running When You Wash the Dog, is found in his tape Live at Lassen, produced by Live Oak Recordings in Austin, Texas. The message is a sound one, even if you don't have a dog, or if you do have a dog and don't wash it.
Please don't leave the water.
water running when you wash the dog, or when you do the dishes, or you finish with the lawn. Install a smaller shower head, fix a leaky spout. If we don't waste the water will run out.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 367. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.